I'm glad to see so many people interested in young folks. The problem we are to address this morning has to do with the changes in the development of methodologies for the training of young people. Actually, as we all remember, there were days when family life provided a great deal of strength to the members and the children's children to the third and fourth generation. But all this is more or less changed. The great modifying or regulating intensities of the moment are in the hands largely of peer groups of young people themselves and the media. Instead of the individual growing up in a home, he is largely growing up in a pandemonium. Now, this does not mean there are not good homes, but it means there are not enough of them, enough to meet the balance of the changes that society has brought about in the last few years. We think of change in the wrong way, usually. We think of change as something that happens, and then things more or less settle back and go on as they always were. But this is not true. All change of major importance has an enduring effect, and very often changes the entire course of the future of a nation or a family. The main problem we see in such things is the invention of the automobile. The Ford car didn't seem particularly dangerous to anybody. Many thought it would be pretty good to get away from the cruelty to animals of the old days of trucking. No one thought of it except as an invention. But there isn't a single step of history since the invention of that car that has not been influenced and modified by it. Today, as we look at the freeways, they are the long shadow of Ford's flivver. They are something that inevitably happened as the result of a single incident that changed the course of history. Another one of these history-changing incidents was the airplane. This has, to a somewhat lesser degree, affected civilian life, but it has had a tremendous impact upon military procedures. The media, television, motion pictures, each of these things was considered to be something interesting in itself. People became very much involved with it, but no one realized, actually, that the world would never be the same once these inventions come into use. They change the future. They require not only a well-thought-through plan, but they demand from every human being major modifications in personal conduct. The individual can no longer live the way he lived before these changes came about. And in the present century, the rate of change has escalated tremendously. In the year 1900, things were not so different than the way they were in 1850. But by 1950, the change in the century, the whole past had been changed, modified, and a large part of our common policy, conduct, and code became obsolete. Now, in the 16th and early 17th century, Comenius, the Moravian educator, established the concept of the public school. Prior to that time, most schools were in the keeping of the church or of guilds, or for the education of the children of the nobility. Comenius was the one who told Europe that the educational system had to be changed, that there was absolutely necessary for someone, something, some way to protect the moral growth of children. He suggested, as the most reasonable point of view, that those best fitted to tell children the facts of life were their own parents. And in those days, this was probably true, for there was comparatively little that was unusual in the life of the individual. He grew up in a community, lived and died there. He perpetuated the business and policies of his fathers and grandfathers. And he bestowed these concepts, opinions, beliefs, and properties upon his children. This has completely changed. Now, this change has brought to focus a number of points that we like to ignore. We like to assume that things will go on as they always have, and that the present will not change the future. That the future that we look for could be 16th or 17th century, but if we want it, we can have it. But the truth is, we can't. We cannot go back to a way of life with which we are no longer in any harmony or understanding. So we now had the problem of Comenius and trying to find some way to do something for the public school system. When he came along, there wasn't any. So there were many ways of improving it. But there was a definite pattern of processes. Children learn at home, for the most part. A child in a farming community in 1840 or 50 received only a few months schooling a year. The rest of the time, the child had to work on the farm with its parents. So the desires of education were simple, and the final end of education was reading, writing, and arithmetic, plus integrity. The schools or the parents' guilds or whatever constituted education provided the three R's. The only other factor possible was religion. The local church had to do with the spiritual destiny of the farmers and merchants of the communities. This church had as its primary instruction ethics, integrity, and the recognition of a divine power that must be obeyed. This was not difficult to believe in times when there was no real Darwinism in circulation. There were very few agnostics and practically no atheists. The families themselves had religious background. Of course, it would be noticeable then as now that these families did not live their religion too well. They accepted it, supported it, and affirmed it, but largely lived according to the pressures of their own personalities. So Comenius thought the possibility of what was called the mother school, in which the child learned first that which was of most importance, ethics and integrity. It was far better for the child to be a good person than to have a fantastic education which he was going to abuse. Also, no matter how much knowledge descended upon him in the course of centuries, he was still in a position to control that knowledge by ethics. Therefore, the individual had a first line of defense in the ethical instruction which was part of his environmental support. This is largely done away with at the present time. The mother school of Comenius faded away into the public school system. And the public school system has continued to grow in influence, but for some reason that is hard to define, the entire ethical structure has collapsed. It has vanished, faded away. The reason it has faded, no question, is that the success mania, wealth and power and fame have become the principal objectives of human life. Now, not long ago, we had an experience, or the world had an experience, of people who developed unfortunate narcotic habits, and perfectly knowingly and well informed killed themselves in a few years. Why? Because there was no perspective on life. There was no preparation for adversity of any kind. There was no directive to inspire the individual to rise above his own pleasures and his own conveniences. The educational system came to a dead standstill. Actually, I read a couple of days ago in a recent public scientific publication that, as usual, the Japanese are trying to do something about it. And they are realizing definitely that the great economic empire they're building up is suspended from one single thread. And if anything happens to that thread, all is lost. And that thread is honor. No matter how much you build, you're going to have strikes, you're going to have all kinds of inferior productions, self-centeredness, conspiracies, and terrorism, as long as success, regardless of methodology, is the only objective. Now, what is public school doing about that? What school is teaching the individual to build that type of character which can resist the pressure of a peer group, rise above the pressures of the media, and live a decent life? We are going further and further into the depths of science. We are trying to discover more and more about the cellular construction of this and that and something else. But we are allowing these young people to graduate in science without the slightest sense of understanding of integrity. And we are not waking to the fact that without integrity, all else is going to fail. We are not putting principles to work in people. We are not doing the things that will ensure that we're going to move into the next century with a reasonable degree of security. Now, we know these things are happening, but we know that people can do something about these things. And many people think with Comenius that the real place where the young people should gain integrities is at home, that they can never be taught anything as powerful as good example. If the family they admire, if the parents they respect, are worthy of their understanding and cooperation, there is a good probability that the child will be strongly influenced by that and will keep a certain amount of honor. Now, the science is approaching this in a little different way. It has gone into heredity. It has tried to prove that the attitudes that we cherish today descend to us through the bloodstream, and that the individual is the production of generations of forebears and ancestors, and that all this adds together to make a complex character or personality with which the individual now must struggle for the rest of his life. What he inherits is a problem, and in many cases, a disaster. So we're not sure anymore that it is possible to assume that we can depend upon the family or society or education or even religion to make sure that our young people grow up with a certain degree of decency. We need this strength, but where is it? So we come to another interesting problem. How does the individual fit into this? The Bible says, as the twig is bent, so the tree is inclined. Now, this is true and was more true in olden days. But now there's something else creeping into this equation which we have not considered. How is the twig bent? Is it really bent by early life? Is the family situation the source of the characters, temperaments, and personalities with which we must go through life? There seems to be some doubt of this. A family of five children, all in the same home, with the same parents, do not develop in similar ways. Out of those five, several, two or three, may do very well. But of those five, we're almost certainly going to find one neurotic. Or we're going to find one bitterly competitive. We are going to find one more violent and another more sulky. We're going to find one that is optimistic by nature and another who is always drenched in their own pessimism. Now, if they all came from the same family, they all grew up in the same home, they all had the same opportunity, why are they so different? They have all been subject to the same twig bending, but they've had very different lives. Now, there are several possibilities that have not yet been thoroughly explored in this matter. One of the possibilities, of course, that is now coming into focus is prenatal trauma. In other words, the condition of being born can be very difficult, although the infant has no conscious memory of it. The problems of the mother prior to the birth of the child can certainly have a conditioning effect, first chemically and then psychochemically. The actual problem of coming into this world can be painful and terrifying. So there is a little discussion now as to how to ease that situation. One of the new ideas in this field is water birthing, in which children born in or very near the surface, but underwater, seem to have less trauma and the mother less difficulty. This would or might indicate that the child's subconscious will have less of fear and therefore will not come into this world dreading it before it gets here. Or has the first life experience is pain, suffering, trouble, inconvenience, and very often a weak family background behind it. Now another point comes into this problem, which not generally receives much consideration. If the law of reincarnation is correct, and as many who believe it very devoutly and have a lot of supporting evidence, then the individual does not come into the world brand new. The child is not a handful of putty that is going to depend entirely upon being molded and modeled by parental or environmental pressures. The child brings its disposition with it. Now, if we assume that nature has a pattern of laws operating, it is quite reasonable to assume that these patterns are operating within the child, that it is born to a destiny or a purpose. It is born to enlarge an area of knowledge and correct an area of foolishness or mistakes. It is here to grow and to learn. Now, the learning does not have to be painful. This does not take away the parental participation in this affair. But supposing we say, for example, that one of the five children in the family is obviously much more serious, much more aloof from worldliness than the others. This child is just as easily handled by family understanding as long as the parents do not personally have an antagonism to the attitude that the child is born with. If a parent is very selfish and self-centered, and the child is naturally generous and altruistic, it becomes the moral duty of the parent to change the child. The child being too young to be able to change the parent, and because these rules do not work both ways, that is almost inevitably going to result in trauma for the child. and the adult will always assume that he or she is right. The adult has a background of practical world experience, which it feels necessary to communicate to the child. No one pauses to find out what this adult attitude really has accomplished for the adult. Is the individual who knows all the answers living any better than the individual who doesn't know the answers? In many instances, if these answers are purely materialistic and are based largely upon concepts of wealth and security, the advice given to the child is comparatively worthless. It will produce for the child the same thing it may produce for the adults, and that is a divorce. They are not able to solve it this way. Therefore, as the family breaks down, as home life is disrupted, as economic pressures increase, as the cost of doing almost everything is multiplied, the influence of the parent on the child is not nearly as constructive as it was when that same attitude was supported by the community, the religion, and the school. The parent now stands alone, trying to hold the line against a generation of disillusioned young people. Young people who, looking around, come to the very painful but realistic attitude that why should they follow systems, ideas, and policies which have brought their own ancestors to the brink of extinction? This type of thinking has to have something done to work with it. Now, the possibility of the loss of home life is now moving into another cycle. And like the invention of the Ford car, this cycle is not going to merely produce an equality in economics. It is going to change the history of the world as long as the foreseeable future. Now, this does not mean that the change will be bad, but it is a change that must be adjusted to. And the failure of adjustment is going to result in generation after generation of underprivileged children. The adjustment is this: that survival in our present economic pressure is demanding a two-income family. It means that both parents must work. Now, as far as we are able to say this matter, certainly both parents are privileged to work. There should be no effort to disparage this right. The individual is an individual. The father is an individual and the mother is an individual. But the problem that results from this situation is what is going to happen to the third individual, the child. Now, the gradual disappearance of the home may be good in the long run, but it is going to present some terrific problems. It is going to confront us with a new way of life that is going to touch every nation on earth, every art and science, every economic structure, every religion. Things will never be as they were before. And in this, we have one point of insecurity which we must do something with. And that is that the loss of the home leaves the newborn child, or the very young child, on the horns of a dilemma. Years ago, when it was necessary for single parents to work, a grandfather, a grandmother, an aunt, or an uncle could step in, or would. But today, this is no longer feasible. These older people have their own lives and are perfectly convinced that destiny intended them to be just as successful as they could be under any possible opportunity. Therefore, the idea that they are going to sit home and allow the young people to go out and accumulate their fortunes, or at least accumulate the payment on the house, this is not going to happen. And in the midst of this, we have the child. What are we going to do about this? How are we going to change this? Well, in some of the socialized countries, the state takes over the parental responsibilities of the young. The children become wards of the state and are given certain visitation privileges with their parents, but all their necessities and all the way of life is in the hands of the social system. Now, this has certain advantages, certainly. It makes certain that the child is not left alone in a dangerous situation. But it also opens the way for the indoctrination of that child with whatever political or religious attitudes dominate the social system. It means that the individual is going to be gradually transformed into a unit in a collective attitude, whether this be a financial attitude, a social, or a political attitude. This means the child now has an early environment, and the twig is being bent by the prevailing political system. Now, this seems maybe could be very good. It might account in many ways for an improvement in the condition of the underprivileged levels of society. It could help to prevent hunger and sickness among the young. It could do a great deal to free parents to what? Not to a life of their own, but to a continual employment in the system. The parent does not get rid of a responsibility when the society takes over the child. He is simply privileged to take on more of the responsibility of the political structure under which he functions. So this does not seem to be an entirely satisfactory answer either. Now we go along a little further in this problem, and we discover that the children themselves break down into several different general classifications. Children are idealistic or materialistic because of qualities and characteristics within themselves. If in a parental society a child shows too much materialism, the parent will try to balance the situation. And if the child is overly theologically dominated, the parent again will try to change the situation. But with no restraint, the child then becomes a ward of the state and must follow all the mores of that social system. This being true, we have to face the effect of this on various generations to come. We have recognized in the last 25 to 35 years the tremendous rise of personal ambitions and personal determinations for individual success. We have also had this tremendous realization, this great leap into the future, as it has been called, long enough now to see a few of the consequences. And to use a simple statement, the great leap has fallen on its face. We are not getting the great advance that we've been talking about. We have been getting computerization, mechanization. We have been developing many criminal institutions. We have terrorists, fanatics, and a whole group of delinquencies that we thought were buried in Egypt or Greece 2,000 years ago. But they're with us still. And there seems to be this amazing situation of the country, Europe, the civilized nations of the world, fully capable of thinking, who are absolutely unaware or completely overwhelmed by the present situation. They do not know what to do. They keep on going along their old ways. They're going to keep right on moon shooting or whatever it may be. But beneath them and in their social system, society is in trouble. It is in serious trouble, a trouble that is going to affect the health of future generations. We are producing more and more parents who are developing serious neurotic tendencies, and we are producing more children who are born neurotics and will develop the situation more and more. Now, if we go to reincarnation as a factor in this, we come upon an interesting possibility. These difficult children that come into the world, and nearly all families have a few of them, these difficult children are here to get over the difficulty. They are here to realize that their attitudes must either be constructive or they are going to suffer. The difficult child is in need of enlightenment. The difficult child will never succeed by nursing the difficulty. If he is selfish and no one changes this attitude, he will wreck his own career and probably blight several generations who may come after him. Everything that is wrong in him, that is here, he has an opportunity to study firsthand. There are very few vice-ridden people today who are not surrounded by other vice-ridden people. They all can see what is happening to their neighbors, their relatives, their associates, their countries, and their world. They must realize that we are all in serious trouble. But to them, or at least to many, there are various evasions. One of the most common evasions we have in life is the evasion of not thinking about it, just simply overlooking the whole thing, taking it for granted that it's impossible, taking it for granted that we are impossible, and taking for granted that the answer is going to be that the impossible will reap its own harvest. All this means to many young people, particularly in the drug addicts field, that now is the only moment in which you can do what you please. You can be happy even if it's drug-ridden. But the idea of sobering up, there is no incentive for it. And by the time the individual wakes up, he's in a terrible situation himself, and his community is in a worse situation. Now, some way, we have to get at the problems here and see what we can do about it. I think that the real answer to the whole thing has always rested in the fact that no nation has ever survived without some kind of a spiritual moral code. This code may appear to be inadequate, and looking back upon other nations, we are inclined to regard their godlings as merely superstitious inventions. If that is true, we have one other point to remember, namely that our present condition and what we regard and respect is also a superstitious belief. The way we are living is no improvement over the various hierarchies of deities available to our ancestors. All of them had one thing in common. There was a rule that somebody had to keep. And there was a power that could demand the fulfillment and obedience to that rule. By becoming completely materialistic, we have removed the need for change in ourselves. We are determined, therefore, to view life as a single episode extending from the cradle to the grave, and that during this period of life, the supreme achievement, the ultimate success, is to have fun. One of the reasons why we should have fun is because we're not sure there's any place afterwards that's going to be fun. In fact, we're not sure there's going to be anything. As one said to me not long ago, a rather curious statement, he said, you know, I'm not sure that I'll even have a memory after I leave this world. Maybe I cease. But if I have a memory, I hope it'll be a memory of the good things I had here. Well, if the materialist is right, he's not going to remember the good things he had here more than he remembers anything. Therefore, there is no future in a materialistic philosophy. And there is a tendency now for the world in general to be infected with the no future attitude, in which there is no use trying because it makes no difference in the end. However, there's another point on this even the materialist has a difficulty with. No matter how materialistic we are and how much we deny the reality of ethics, we still face the realization that while we may not go on, we are leaving behind us generations to come. We are leaving children, grandchildren. We are leaving destinies to go to pieces because of the stupidity of our present points of view. If there is no future for the individual, there is certainly to be remembered that his children and their children have a right to some kind of a world. And if he wrecks this world before they grow up, everybody is going to be worse off. All this then comes right straight back to how are we going to bend the twig. The idea that the parent is going to do it is becoming, for the most part, inadequate. It may well be that an occasional family will have a tremendous strength. I've known such families. They could face a universal deluge without one moment thought of compromising their principles. But such consistency, such integrity, and such devotion is comparatively rare. What we have more likely in this situation is that the person tries for a little while, finds nothing but obstacles, and either gives up and renounces his objectives or else stays on and remains a martyr. This type of situation is not the answer. So the way in which the twig is bent comes finally back to the law that we all have to face. We are all looking for some kind of a structure, a pattern, a policy, which will enable us to achieve our purposes without major changes in ourselves. Such a policy does not exist, and never has, and never will. The individual must now take over his own destiny. He is going to be forced by circumstances to think through the problems of his own existence. He knows when he starts out in life that he makes mistakes. He realizes in childhood that what he does wrong. As he gets a little older, he may have an occasional contact with law and order and learn things. He gets on the campus of a school and he will be tempted with every fallacy of the day. And he's going to see child after child fall apart. He's going to get up to the college level, university level, and find that he is in the midst of a Babylonian situation. Nothing but trouble, misery, exploitation, and dissipation. So, if he hasn't strength enough to rise to some of these values, then he is not learning anything from his own examples and from what he learns. Now, there are ways he could learn, but there's a conspiracy against him. It's perfectly possible for him to learn a great deal from good reading. But books now are largely written to sell, not to teach. And they are not going to put anything in that is going to bar a customer from accepting the book. Instead of being told the facts of life, they are going to be told what we are supposed to do to maintain the status in quo. We may be told how bad everything is, but we are not told that it is in our power to do anything about it. There's always this process in which a great world movement has to save us. Now we can begin very carefully looking over the causes of our own immediate problem. And this applies to persons of all age groups. Any child young enough or old enough to sit in front of a TV, and any person of advancing years who is able to sit in the background and watch the TV, is going to be deprived of integrities. He is going to have a conditioning that is basically wrong. He is going to be taught the glory of crime, or he is going to be taught that the most important emotion that possible in him is excitement, and the platforms and the programs must become more violent every moment. He will find all these things catering to his failings rather than to his accomplishments. Instead of building him in strength, it is going to cater to the most selfish and useless factors of his personality. The same is almost certainly going to be true in higher education. He is not going to be taught what is necessary for him to know, and that is that his destiny is in his own keeping. He has the right to grow, and he also has the privilege of falling apart. He must decide for himself. It's not necessary for anyone to tell him. He can see it. The great textbook is open to him, where he can actually see among his own friends, his family, his community, the forces operating upon society. He knows perfectly well that he shouldn't drive a car under the influence of liquor. Well, he drives the car. And in so doing, not only breaks law, but because of his own attitude, creates resentment in him against law. For if he is wrong, no one is supposed to interfere with the privilege of doing exactly what he pleases. So a world now dedicated to doing what it pleases is pleasing to do the wrong things, and out of it must have the consequences we look for. Now, if we have young people growing up, anyone, say, between the ages of about 5 or 4, and young people up to 90 or 95, the process of growing starts now. The idea of the twig being bent is no longer referable to the juvenile. The individual has a bent twig whenever he fails to make the adjustments necessary to maintain his integrity. When he surrenders to certain negative attitudes in his own life and in his own policies, he is bending the twig, even though he may be far past the normal bending age. He may feel that this bending has been done in childhood, but a bad habit nursed through maturity will bend him just as badly and just as quickly. Whenever anything arises that isn't good for him, and he endures it, and maybe appreciates it and glorifies it, he is getting into trouble. So at some level in life, perhaps after an unhappy educational experience, and for most students it is an unhappy experience, he may go out into the great world and realize of a sudden that he's completely unequipped. He doesn't know anything that's going to help him to build a life. He may be able to drop into a fairly remunerative slot somewhere in industry. He might become the third vice president of something just after graduating cum laude from the university. But 6 months later, the firm he's in will fold up, that he'll start all over again. Or the changing policy will eliminate the technical skill which he has spent 17 or 18 years acquiring, and he has to start over again. All of the ways of life as we know are based upon patterns of constant change, in which an individual who cannot change as rapidly as his times is simply left behind. So each person has to begin to think through and see what it's all about, and see what he can do with his own personal character, to see how much selfishness is influencing his daily life. And when he finds that out, he has graduated in one course at least. And it doesn't make any difference, really, whether he was told this and the example was given to him by a loving father and mother, or if he did not have such attentions, then he's going to find it, or have to find it, when he's 20, 30, 40, or 50.